This week's episode is brought to you by the Retail Innovation Conference and Expo.
I think in a world where venture capital is easy to raise, like there's something wrong. And I think that we're sort of seeing dealing with some of the overhang from that today. Our firm is very focused, has always been very focused on businesses that can really be commercially valuable in addition to interventions that create a lot of value for customers.
You're listening to Retail Remix, your inside access to candid conversations with the people shaping retail's future. Here's your host, Alicia Esposito.
I always love speaking with folks from the VC world. I feel like they have a very unique perspective on what's happening in the world of retail, what's happening with the consumer, and of course, what it takes to build a brand and a product that really resonates. So today I'm sitting down with Ben West, who's a partner at Juxtapose. And the reason why I really wanted to chat with him is because his firm takes a very distinct approach to funding and building its businesses. We're going to get into that. We're going to get into the different approaches to funding. But it's especially interesting considering the company's emphasis on more service-oriented business models. So we get into healthcare, the synergies that are happening with retail, and of course, possible learnings for the folks listening that come purely from the product perspective. Listen in because Ben has a very unique, I think, perspective on what's happening in the world of retail and how VC is fueling it all. Ben, thanks so much for taking the time to be on the show. It is so great to meet you and really excited to dig into the conversation.
Nice to meet you as well, which I'm excited to be here.
Let's start at the high level, just a little bit about Juxtapose, because what I found most interesting is that the firm is described as a quote-unquote creation-oriented investment firm, which I feel like packs a punch. There's a lot to it. Can you expand upon that definition, what it means, and most of all, how it kind of dictates the work you do?
It's an important question, and obviously one we get a lot. We're a pretty strange firm, all things considered. I'd say that there really aren't. When you look across the investing landscape, you see big pockets like private equity, venture capital, hedge funds. And I think what distinguishes our firm from those firms is that we're typically starting our work from zero. So our investment process actually begins before a company exists. We're a creation-oriented investment firm, and that really means our investment process is focused on companies that don't exist yet. So we have a team of about 15 people. Most of them actually came from hedge funds, private equity funds. And then we also have a team that came from a human-centered design background, so mostly from IDEO and organizations like that. The two of these teams basically collaborate to uncover opportunities for new businesses. We spend a lot of time in big categories of consumer spend, so healthcare, financial services, property tech, big pockets of consumer spend that in general are not particularly well served, and where there's consistently an opportunity to use technology, understand changing consumer expectations, and in that process, identify an opportunity for a new business. So our investment process is based entirely around identifying those opportunities for new businesses. And then we run a process that is a mix of an entrepreneur's excitement and hustle to basically capitalize on a new opportunity, mixed with an investment firm's rigor and diligence and resources to really figure out if that's a good idea or not. And so our firm is totally based around this process. We make two types of investments at the firm. One is an investment that looks like a venture investment. So we'll invest $2.5 to $10 million of equity to get a business started. That business will grow primarily organically. That's one flavor, and that's been the dominant flavor historically. We also have another flavor we call platform builds, which actually starts with a larger pool of capital and then grows through primarily M&A, but with a lot of the same technology process, a great team that characterizes a great venture business. It just happens to be growing through M&A. And so a lot of our process is based around identifying a great opportunity for your business, validating that it's a very good opportunity, really high upside, but very low risk. And then we run a process to build a team around that opportunity. So at some point during our investment process, we'll meet a great entrepreneur, start to work with that individual to build a team around them. And so a big part of our process is also focused on talent. And we really focus on partnering with extremely seasoned, very proven individuals. Our CEOs are not people who are in their 20s and operating garages. We're really focused on people who have, in many cases, been CEOs before. In some cases, been CEOs of public companies or private equity-backed companies, run teams of hundreds or thousands of people, and really operated at the level of scale and sophistication that we aspire each of our businesses to get to.
No, that's great. Very interesting stuff. So I'm wondering if you can kind of expand upon just like the art and science of it all. So you take this concept, you know that there's market opportunity, and then you allocate the team towards that opportunity. How do you get from like point A to point B of like actually building the business or the brand? So I know you dabble in a lot of like service oriented type retail concepts, but then one of the brands that you do work with and have helped grow is Care Of, which has seen some incredible expansion lately. So I know it's probably not a silver bullet and like every process is not the same, but like how do you kind of go from like, okay, this concept, this product, this experience has weight, there's market opportunity, to establishing the plan for growing it, depending on the path, I guess, that you're going to take as far as that partnership goes?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. So maybe it's helpful to just touch for a moment on our investment process.
Yeah, okay.
Each juxtaposed business shares a consistent investment framework. We call it ICF, or intervention. So what are we going to do differently that really creates an enormous amount of new value for customers? The commercial lens. So is this a really high return on capital business? Something that's going to be very valuable, trade at a high multiple, and generate real profitability? And then the future component. The future component is a combination of, is this business aligned with where the world is going? But also, is this mission something that we'd be really proud of having spent 5 or 10 years on when we're kind of looking back at our careers? So those are the inputs to a new opportunity for us. But your question was more focused on, okay, how do we actually bring that to life? And this is actually an area where our firm also has a lot of IP, a lot of repeated both capabilities, experiences, and scars. So we know a lot of our expertise internally is basically going from, okay, we have an idea on a page, we have the makings of a great team, we have a great founder and CEO. How do we actually take that business to the next level? And I'd say, particularly for our venture-oriented businesses, we're really focused on getting to enough proof points for the business, some early proof points of success that will allow us to continue to finance the business and continue to pursue basically the next stage of growth. So our firm's financing model is really focused on being able to fund the building of a team, the building of the initial product. So in the case of Care Of, we set up a facility that, you know, not in a fully automated way yet, but in a way that was good enough for that stage of the business, could create these personalized vitamin packs for our customers. And we also had a customer acquisition model, a customer experience model and associated software, and then this facility that I mentioned that could actually fulfill on that initial wedge product. We think of building the business in two phases broadly. The first is the wedge business, and the second is the squint. So the wedge business is the first, usually a very detailed plan, very detailed product vision for an achievable and valuable intervention that allows us to get to the first, call it $50 or $100 million of revenue. It's in the case of Care Of. And the squint is really the set of things that you can do after you're in that position. So Care Of has a differentiated relationship with its customers. There's a bunch of downstream opportunities for that business. We actually sold that business to Bayer, who is an investor in the business and has been a great partner in the company. But so we're no longer involved in that journey. But Care Of is in a position now where they're starting to transcend from the wedge business, which was personalized nutrition, personalized vitamin packs, to a series of downstream consumer health opportunities. And they're on that journey with Bayer at this point. In terms of capabilities, like there's quite a broad set of things that we do in the 0 to 1 phase. So everything from the process of building technology, and we have strong thoughts about how technology for an early stage business should be built, but also things like brand. So we have a mix. We usually leverage a mix of in-house designers. We partner really closely with the management team, and then we work with usually a best-in-class third-party brand agency to bring a brand to life that really communicate something new to the market and something new to customers.
Oh, this is very, very interesting. So as we think about brands, you know, I always like to ask folks that either have a big portfolio of brands or work with a big portfolio of brands, like what brand means today, right? Because there are so many. I feel like anybody could kind of be a brand now. And I feel like at the same time, there are so many dynamics at play, especially in retail, whether it's, you know, firmly just product or it's product and services, the dynamics of what resonates with consumers, how they buy, that's always changing as well. So it's just like a very interesting dynamic time, in my opinion, around brand building, brand development. So I'm curious, like, if you have a certain viewpoint of what makes a successful brand today, how your firm thinks about a viable / powerful brand, maybe that'll provide some insight to our listeners as like how you define and think about brand holistically.
I think brand, it's kind of I have a strange relationship with brand. And I think that relationship has changed over the course of my career. Earlier in my career, I had a professor named Youngmi Moon, who I took a branding class with, and she described a brand as the window to the company, which I think is like probably the best aspirational frame for what a brand should be and can be. I think a lot of brands fall short of that. I think too often brands are built in a way that either isn't consistent with what the company can really achieve. And so it's no longer really the window to the business, or it's designed in a way that is not deeply resonant or deeply connected to the end customer. We think about brand mattering in a few ways, but I think the most important from our perspective is that it starts with a really deep understanding of the end customer's needs, pain points, experiences, and then works backwards from the way that your intervention actually can positively impact their life and positively respond to their problem or the opportunity that's in front of them. So one of my favorite brands in our portfolio is a business called Herself Health. Herself is a primary care business that's focused on serving women that are Medicare age. So I think healthcare in general is a really interesting place to build brands, because healthcare is really about serving people often in some of the most sensitive and vulnerable moments in their life. And you're bringing together people to do that who are often feel like they're doing their life's work and are doing their life's work. And so the brand becomes the thing that reminds everyone, all the employees, why they're there, but also is the first thing the customer sees or the first thing the patient sees. And it should speak to them in a way that resonates against this, either the negative experience that they're coming from, the health condition that they're dealing with or worried about, or the future that they're excited about and that you're going to help them enjoy or live better in. And so I think the brands can be really powerful. They're really important, but you have to approach it with some respect and some seriousness and make sure that you're really signing up for what you're communicating in the brand. That's maybe too abstract, but that's how we think about the brand creation process. And it's something that we enjoy, but really take seriously.
Right. Yeah. Well, ultimately, it always has to tie back to what the consumer needs are, you know, what the total size of the opportunity is. And I think healthcare is such an interesting space because we are seeing that convergence of like retail and healthcare. Like we're seeing like the Amazons and the Walmarts try to get into healthcare services. You know, obviously telemedicine was a really big thing during the pandemic, but now we're seeing that continue to stabilize and scale in different ways. So I think we will continue to see those synergies across the board. But I guess ultimately the takeaway is that it does tie to a very intimate need that we all have, ties to specific challenges or stages in our life. And that's why it's so resonant and it's so impactful. But I mean, in other areas, like how do you go about identifying those opportunities or even gaps in the market? Like sometimes I think it's interesting, right? Like some brands really effectively identify what doesn't exist and they capitalize on that. Or in other cases, it's like a challenger brand, right? And there are a lot of players in a specific category or market, but they do something in a completely different way that really makes it stand out. So I guess my question for you is, in a very roundabout way, like how do you kind of identify what those opportunities are and really what approach to take for a particular business, whether it's new market, clear gap, versus, oh, this company is doing something very different and valuable, and we should try and capitalize on that.
Yeah, I think it starts, and I'm realizing that in some circles, obviously, brand means company, and some circles, brand means the name and the visual identity of the business. So I was thinking in the previous response much more about the visual identity, what the brand like look and feel is. I think when it comes to looking for an opportunity for a new business, for us, it really starts, I would say that there is actually two paths, I think, to identifying a new opportunity for a company. And we've employed both historically. The first is it really starts with a market. I think if a market is large enough and is fairly old school, you can bet that there's some obsolete assumptions about how customers are served, how the business works, how product works. There's some obsolete assumptions that you can capitalize on. And there's going to be a lot of people that are not particularly well served in that market. If it's big enough, you may find that you can basically run a process where you get to know that market really well, and you're effectively going and looking for opportunities. I think the other form is what we call a value lever focused approach. So if you start instead with a new technology or a new process or a new way of doing things, a value lever approach basically says, here's one market or one example of this approach creating a lot of value for customers. I bet there's other places where we could apply that approach. So in the case of, you mentioned One Medical and Amazon before, I think in the case of One Medical, One Medical did a really good job of consumerizing the primary care experience for a certain type of customer, making that more convenient, making that more accessible, doing that work in a retail location that you'd be happy to walk into. That was part of the actual inspiration for Tend. Tend is a business in our portfolio that's delivering best-in-class dentistry for consumers, primarily in urban areas. And if you see a Tend on the street or you go visit a Tend and you're also a One Medical customer, you'll probably see some of the similarities. It doesn't look at all like it. Dentistry is a very different business, very different problem than primary care. But there's some features of it that just feel massively upgraded relative to the way most dental practices work. You show up, your visit starts on time, visit ends on time. You have a great experience. The whole practice runs like clockwork. You can book online. You know when your visit's coming up. You have perfect visibility to what you'll pay at the dentist. There's no surprises. And so Tend is a 80 NPS business. That's, you know, over $100 million in revenue today. We started in 2018 on the back of this very differentiated customer experience that reflects an upgrading of a consumer health experience. You could say it was pretty analogous to One Medical, but that process of identifying a value lever, in this case, consumerization of a previously pretty messy healthcare services experience, and then applying that into another very, very large and attractive industry like dentistry.
This is very, very interesting. So, I mean, with all of this in mind, you know, I'm curious because, you know, we have some folks listening to this podcast, you know, maybe they're in purely retail or retail/services. Maybe they're looking for investment in growing and scaling their business. So I want to get like just your overall perspective on what this climate currently looks like, because we've covered a few very distinct specific stories of companies that got a lot of funding, got a lot of support from the VC world. You know, now they're reaching this point in their growth story, it's not sustainable, or they're not seeing the results they want. It's basically, in so many words, creating a lot of debate and discussion around, you know, I guess, you know, some of these buzzy brands, whether they actually had that quality of business, the foundation in place to begin with, which is all valid. But I guess my question for you is, how have the dynamics of building and scaling a business, how have they all been changing, evolving? And I guess the bigger question for you is, have those discussions or those examples impacted the way your team thinks about investing and which brands to try and grow and scale? Because just looking at it from the outside in, it just seems like a very interesting space to be in, especially considering there's so much opportunity. But, you know, some of those headlines are kind of hard to ignore right now.
It absolutely is. And I think I would say that, you know, reflecting on the last few years, like there was certainly a period where I'd say like raising venture capital should be really hard. It's actually a business that's premised on picking one or two great companies out of a pool of hundreds and making a meaningful investment in those businesses. I think in a world where venture capital is easy to raise, like there's something wrong. And I think that we're sort of seeing dealing with some of the overhang from that today. Our firm is very focused, as has always been very focused on businesses that can really be commercially valuable in addition to interventions that create a lot of value for customers. Our firm has always been very focused on business models that can generate very attractive unit economics and high returns on capital, but also can scale to very profitable businesses. And part of that is based on our activity in categories where businesses tend to make money, like dentistry, healthcare services, financial services. There's a real attractive base of businesses in those industries. And we're able to enter those attractive industries with a better mousetrap and a better model. And so we're very fortunate that each of the businesses that we've started and invested in has hit all of the milestones you'd expect a great venture business to hit. You know, we have businesses of different ages, but each of the businesses in our portfolio has hit the fundraising milestones and growth milestones that you'd expect for a great venture business. So we're very, very fortunate in that. I think particularly for a business to call it get to, I think Series B, there's something like a 4% chance. And each of the five businesses in our portfolio that are old enough to have raised Series Bs have all reached that milestone. So I think there's a tendency to treat fundraising as the endpoint. That's very much not the endpoint. But I think it's never been more important to be very focused on really high return on capital business models that can be built without heroic amounts of financing. So it's always been our mentality. But I think there were definitely some periods in 2021 where we wondered if we shouldn't be doing something differently or raising a lot more money or doing something in crypto. And, you know, we were wondering if we should do that. At this point, we're glad that we didn't really change our formula.
Right. Yeah. I'm sure like there's always that feeling of FOMO anytime there's like a big market that's exploding or a big trend. I mean, I think tech in particular, like there's always something, right? So I totally understand that. And I'm curious, like based on your experience and just being so immersed in this world every day, I guess this is more of a prescriptive question for the folks listening. How should brands, operators, business owners even, how should they be thinking about fundraising, especially in this market, right? And considering all the different players, again, the business dynamics that are happening right now, is there anything that they should be thinking about, anything they should remember, consider, or even like, is there anything that they get wrong about this process that you want to call out? I mean, we can kind of take this however you want.
I would give them the advice that I give some of my friends who are running venture businesses, and the advice I give our portfolio CEOs is the market has definitely changed. I think there's still capital out there for great businesses, but a lot of investors are kind of wondering, I would say that they're a little less sure, certainly about businesses that have, you know, if you think about the idyllic or like the platonic ideal of a venture business is basically a vertical SaaS or like either vertical SaaS or like enterprise SaaS business today. It's pretty easy for investors to wrap their head around it. There's definitely like a deep market of capital for those businesses if they're hitting their milestones. And there's a lot of people that really specialize in that. I would say that there are other business models, particularly I think those in consumer, where there's a lot more investors wondering if they should be making those investments, a lot more venture investors wondering if they should be making those investments. Great businesses will still get financed, but the process will take longer. It'll be more challenging. And the amount of capital you're able to raise will certainly be probably less impressive and exciting. And but you'll be, of course, you'll be just as happy to have raised it. But the market's definitely changed. People should take that into account. And often it requires making, you know, I think anytime you're raising money in a venture environment, you don't know how the process is going to go until you're actually out there talking to venture funds. And venture funds are perfectly happy to tell you that they love the business as long as they need to maintain optionality. And so you really can't take the first couple of comments, in many cases, the first couple of meetings as reality. And you need to be preparing before the fundraise. And actually, you know, basically, as soon as the market materially changes, for that fundraise to be a lot tougher. And there needs to be a plan that takes into account all scenarios, including that you might not be able to raise the money. And so there's just a level of, in each of our boards, we try to have a level of realism and maybe even over pessimism, recognizing that it'd be great if we're wrong and actually things end up being easier than we worried that they might be. But I think without that level of realism, it's really easy to get stuck in a situation where you'd wished you'd made harder decisions earlier. That's maybe a little bit broad, but it's where we try to be a little bit more conservative in how we thought about fundraising. And I have tried to give that advice to my friends outside of Portfolio.
Yeah, no, definitely makes sense. Is that an area of like misconception or like that it is better to take a more conservative approach? Like in general, are there any myths or misconceptions that brand operators have about this process, the outcomes? Like I always wonder if there are any disconnects, I guess, as brands go through this journey.
I think the biggest disconnect, particularly for a first-time founder or a first-time operator, is the disconnect between what you hear from capital markets before you're raising or in the early parts of your fundraise relative to how, like, what will actually happen when the rubber meets the road and somebody has to close, like send a wire. There's really no downside to maintaining optionality if you're a venture or growth investor. And so it's hard to get a really raw read on exactly how financeable and at what terms your business is. And it leads a lot of operators to feel too good for too long about those prospects. So I think if you're getting feedback from the market, I would always try to knock a couple decibels off of, or maybe assume that things might not be as attractive or as strong as what like an initial reaction might suggest.
Got it. No, this has been super fascinating, Ben, just to hear about your company's process, how you are looking at the market. And I'm curious, you know, just to kind of close out, like, what do you think the market holds for the next year? Do you think there is going to be more conservatism, like just considering all of the dynamics at play, not just, you know, the financial market, but also the consumer side of things? And is there anything in particular that you're watching or tracking from a trend perspective that you think is going to impact VC over the next year?
I'm always a little worried about predictions.
Don't mean to put pressure on you. Do it again.
No. My partner Jed likes to say, and he this is not an original quote, but something that he repeats, those who think they have a crystal ball eat glass, which is maybe the, you know, not a great thought to hold in your head. But I think in general, we're expecting somewhat more of the same, probably some ongoing pressure on consumer spending. And I think we don't think a lot about discretionary consumer spending because most of our businesses are playing in categories of retail, or for those that are retail businesses, are playing in categories of retail that are pretty non-discretionary. So we, you know, do a lot in healthcare services. We do a lot in other very non-discretionary financial and consumer services. We don't spend a lot of time thinking about that. I would say, I think what I've heard from smart people in the world is that consumers are continuing to burn down their savings, and that next year, absent a meaningful reduction in interest rates, which I don't think anyone's betting on, you'll see somewhat more consumer pain. At the same time, I think there's a lot that could change in the next 12 months. I think all things considered, though, we're taking the more conservative tack of assuming that in a macro sense, it'll be more of the same, but that you're reaching the point where it will start to feel a little bit more painful for consumers.
Awesome. Well, Ben, this has been super enlightening. It's always interesting to hear what's happening from folks who are inside the four walls, so to speak. And, you know, your process for identifying new opportunities and building those businesses is truly fascinating. So thank you so much for taking the time out, for sharing what all of that means, you know, how the work is done. It's truly interesting stuff. So appreciate the time.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure. Appreciate it, Alicia.
And to all of you listening, if you have any follow-up questions for Ben, we'd love to keep the conversation going on social, at Retail Touchpoints on LinkedIn, at our Touchpoints on X. Like I said a few times over this conversation, it's a very dynamic market, a lot of interesting perspectives, approaches to funding and growing brands. So it's always interesting to get folks in the seat who are doing the work. So happy to make those connections for folks if you would like them and if you would like to dig into this topic further. But for now, that's it from all of us. Be sure to let us know how you like this episode and the series as a whole. Leave us a rating or review on your preferred podcast player. And while you're there, be sure to subscribe to the show. We're always speaking with folks like Ben who are doing this work, building brands, and are shaping the market. So when you do subscribe, you get those episodes delivered right to your device. Thanks again to all of you for listening. We will see you next time. Take care.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Retail Remix. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. You can find us on your favorite podcast player. Until next time, keep mixing it up.